For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we've got a crime scene special. Former CSI T. Orr Munro reveals how her work in the field informed her debut thriller, Breakneck Point. Graham McRae Burnett discusses the real crime memoir that inspired him to write his Bloody Project. And Emma Flint re-examines the evidence in one of the most notorious unsolved crimes in American history, for her novel, Little Deaths. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Breakneck Point is one of the year's most hotly anticipated crime thrillers. Set amid the atmospheric moorlands and shorelands of North Devon, it's a gripping police procedural that seeks to take us behind the police tape and into the heart of the investigation, in the company of its flawed but formidable protagonist. As a former CSI and crime journalist herself, the book's author, T. Orr Munro, brings an authenticity to the story which makes it hard to put down. She joined me from her home in Devon. Tina, welcome to Read On.
Hello there. Thank you very much, Red, for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
The strapline to Breakneck Point is evidence never lies, people do. And your protagonist, Ali Diamond, is honest to a fault. We join her as she, in her capacity as a CSI, is about to give evidence at Exeter Crown Court. And her honesty is going to have serious repercussions for her career.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, it opens with her in court. She's in a murder case. She's surprised to be called because forensic evidence isn't usually challenged in a courtroom scenario. It is fairly conclusive. It's fairly convincing. So we see her arriving at court a little bit unsettled as to why she's there. And as it transpires, as the defence is going through the fingerprint evidence, it becomes very clear to Ali Diamond that she's basically been set up by her own team, if you like, and the evidence has been falsified. And in actual fact, it's looking like a false accusation. So she blows the whistle on corruption, which is absolutely the right thing to do. But then she finds herself in a situation where none of her police colleagues will work with her anymore. And so she's kind of unceremoniously dispatched to the nether ends of Devon. And she finds herself back in North Devon working relatively minor crimes until a body turns up on a quay in a coastal town in North Devon.
Yeah, and she loves her job at a major incident team CSI. She's very passionate about justice. And of course, as soon as the body turns up in Biddecombe, she is wanting to do justice for the victim. And that leads her into conflict with her new boss, who, well, somewhat understandably, is more used to dealing with petty crime in Biddecombe and isn't really looking for a murder.
No, and I was kind of really keen to just show a senior investigating officer as somebody just under enormous pressures, actually. So they are presented with a serious crime. Serious crime, major crime, takes an enormous amount of resourcing, takes an enormous amount of time, obviously, to investigate. And what you find in policing is that you have detective inspectors who are juggling numerous cases. They don't just have one murder to work on at a time. They have many different serious crimes to work upon. And I kind of didn't want to portray him as somebody who was an evil, one-dimensional police officer. I wanted to really get across a little bit that, you know, this man is under pressure. It would suit him to wrap this up very quickly and to make those decisions because he has other jobs that are also calling on his time and also need to be dealt with. And that's really what I wanted to show with the character of D.I. Holt.
And it's that degree of authenticity that you bring to the story that I think really sets it apart. Statistically, we know that the murderer is most likely to be the pretty horrible partner of the murder victim. And that's what the investigating policeman knows. And we as crime fans know this too. And so actually we get to see some of his frustration with Ali, who at her worst can be a real pain in the neck.
Yes, she is, isn't she? Yes, she is. And I think you can see it from his point of view that, you know, he's got the evidence in front of him. And you're absolutely right, Red, to point out, statistically speaking, percentages are incredibly high that you are going to be known to your killer, if you like. And there is a very strong chance they're going to be quite a close family member. And detectives are operating under that knowledge. So it's not unreasonable for him to assume that he knows the answer to this. And, you know, they've got the person in custody and all the evidence is pointing in the right way. And it's only really sort of Ali's tenacity and her attention to detail on a kind of Sherlock Holmes level where she sees something and says, well, it may or may not be related, but I'm not going to take the risk because if this piece of evidence is really significant, we've got to catch the right person for this, not the wrong person. And so that's her position on this. But I sort of think you can see it from both sides, really.
Well, yes, and it's made even more complex by the fact that Ali is also conflicted. She's a single parent to a 15-year-old daughter, and she wants to be there for her daughter, but the demands of her job also means that she can't always do her job as a parent.
No, absolutely right. And I think this is a dilemma for anybody that works in policing, whether you're a single parent or not. I think you find that with shift work and overtime and pressures, that as a journalist, I've interviewed many police officers and they all say the same thing. It is that constant tug between wanting to go out and do a job that they love, where they want to make a difference, and being home in time to see their child's first school play, to be there on sports day. And I think that's a dilemma that really all working parents face. But I think when you're in policing and you're on those shifts, it can be particularly difficult.
Absolutely. And murders quite often happen at very antisocial times.
Yes.
Now, you yourself worked as a crime scene investigator, which helps you bring a large amount of authenticity to this story. You obviously must have felt a lot of those similar pressures and had the same kind of run-ins with police officers where you knew that your expertise might run counter to their suspicions.
Yes, that's very true. Actually, I did it when I was quite young, so I didn't have those family responsibilities at the time. But I was certainly at one job where I'd arrived and the police had caught the burglar running away from the scene. So that was great. They had the burglar in custody and I was there to take the impression of a footprint in the back garden of this person's house because the person had jumped over the fence and they'd run away. So I turned up to take a photograph and do a cast of the footprint. But there was a detective sergeant who was waiting for me. And I was about to take the photograph. He produced a trainer, which he had taken off the boy who was in custody. And he said to me, can you tell me if it's the same shoe? And I looked at him and said, I can't do anything now because you've just appeared with the shoe. And I don't know if you've just made that impression in the ground or you've just turned up with the shoe from the boy in custody. So you've just completely destroyed the scene. I'm not going to do anything now. I'm going to leave. And he was very, very angry. And he phoned my sergeant. And there was a kind of a little bit of a to-do on the telephone. And my sergeant ends up saying, just basically, don't ever, ever do that to any of my scenes crime officers ever again, because he destroyed the scene. There's no way I could do anything once he'd produced this trainer. And I'm stood next to the footprint that the trainer may or may not have made.
Goodness. The work of CSIs has obviously been very much at the forefront of the way that we view crime for the last 15 or so years because of the very successful CSI series from the States. Do you feel that that's actually done crime scene investigation a favour, or do you think it's raised expectations that you hold the secret ingredient to solve all the worst crimes in the world?
That's a really, really good question, actually, Red. I think it's a double-edged sword, if I'm really honest with you. I think the technology and science has just progressed to a point, particularly in the area of DNA, where they can just get amazing results. And also telephones, digital forensics, because, you know, we hold our life on our telephones and the information that they have is just phenomenal. So on one level, it's quite difficult to commit particularly a major crime and get away with it, I would say. But on another level, when you see the CSI shows, their turnaround to get results that have, in quotation marks, gone off to the lab is very, very rapid. And in the real world, where you've got the resourcing pressures at play, you just don't get those responses. Things just take time to filter through and back onto the investigation team. So I think there's that. And I think there's also another issue that some criminals are incredibly savvy. So as fast as the police are, forensics are coming up with these new and incredible ways to catch people, criminals are becoming super aware, we call them forensically aware, and they can go into crimes pretty much knowing what the forensics is going to be, and they will avoid basically putting themselves at risk. The obvious one that they've known for many years, it will be gloves, but they will do other things too to avoid being caught.
That comes through very much in your other protagonist in this book, Simon, the sociopathic murderer. I don't want to say too much, but it is not a spoiler to give his name. We are introduced to him very early on in the story. He is very savvy, and he really is authentically vile and chilling. Where on earth did he come from?
From a very dark place inside me, I think, Red. I think I surprise myself sometimes with Simon. The thing with Simon, he's despicable, and he is meant to be. And I kind of didn't want people to read him and for them to go, well, I kind of quite like the villain in this. You know, I just didn't want that to happen. I wanted people to be repulsed by him and just to go, oh my goodness me, he is just a vile, vile individual, whether he is committing dreadful crime or just interacting normally with his work colleagues and with his wife. That really was the motivator for Simon, that I kind of just didn't want to come away with this and go, have people saying, you know, he was a good psychopath, wasn't he? And he was, and I'm thinking, no, almost like the Hannibal Lecter, where people have got kind of like a sneaking regard for him. And I'm thinking, this guy's a killer. You know, you don't have regards for killer. He's a dreadful, dreadful man who needs to face justice.
Absolutely. And I mean, we can have no sympathy with him at all. I sensed quite a bit of anger in the writing about him as well. And I wondered if possibly that was something that, it was a reaction to some of the cases that you have covered as the editor of a policing magazine.
Yeah, that's a really perceptive comment, actually. I've not thought about that, but I think you are absolutely right. If I look back on initially to my time as a scenes of crime officer, one of the most overriding emotions I have when I dug back into those times was a sense of anger, at my helplessness, at going in when the worst thing had already happened, the crime had already been committed, people had already suffered and would continue to suffer, and feeling that there wasn't really a great deal I could do. Yes, I could bring someone to justice, I could get them on their fingerprints or their DNA, but ultimately, really, what people wanted, Red, was for the crime to have never been committed, for them to have been able to live their lives normally and safely. So I think you're absolutely right. There is anger, that she is angry, and I think there is anger in the writing of Simon. There's a couple of jobs that I was involved in, and I specifically remember being quite distressed by them and feeling one of them involved a young man who had been let out on parole. And I distinctly remember feeling just absolute fury that this person who I knew what crime he'd committed that put him in prison in the first place. And then despite that, they had been let out and they had been in the community, and those other people in the community had no idea what they were dealing with. And that left me really, really angry.
We also see how long-lasting the damage that violence against women and other types of crime lasts for, both in the character of Ali herself and her friend Penny, who was abused by her partner and is still scared 20 years later that he might turn up again.
Yes, that comes from, I spent more time with victims than I did with anybody else. So a police officer is likely to spend obviously a lot of time in the company of the perpetrator, assuming that they catch them. And scenes of crime officers will go in when almost the hubbub has kind of died down, if it's a fairly minor crime, if you like, or even a serious crime, if like an assault. The police will have come in, they'll have done the interviewing, then they go. And then quite often the scenes of crime officer would go in and it would just be one-to-one. You'd be doing photographs or you'd be examining a crime scene. And as a result, I spent a lot of time with victims, and victims made an incredible impression on me. And one thing I came to understand is that it doesn't go the next day, it doesn't go the next week or the next month or the next year, is that quite often some victims live with what's happened really for the rest of their lives, and they adjust their behaviour accordingly. And I did want to show that via a fiction book, if you like, but it was really important to me to show the impact that crime can have on people.
We've touched on a lot of the more serious parts of the book. It is also an incredible page-turning thriller that I finished in a day and a half.
And thank you.
And as the title would suggest, it goes at a breakneck speed. A lot of the tension is set up by your having a dual narrative. We hear Ali's voice, which in the audiobook version is brilliantly brought to life by yes. Olivia Mace.
Yes.
And then a third person rendition of Simon's voice, read chillingly by Chris Dyer. That was a conscious decision, obviously, to write from a dual narrative, and presumably a very easy decision for you and the publishers to make, to have two narrators.
From the word go, I don't think there's any real discussion about it, that it did lend itself to having two separate narrators, and they do an absolutely amazing job. Their voices are spot on, and the voices that I have in my head when I was really writing the novel. So you have that cat and mouse to and fro between these two protagonists, really, or protagonists and antagonists, going right through the book. And yeah, that was a deliberate decision.
I know what the perfect murder looks like. And the slaying of Sian Jones isn't it. Far from it. Her killer, a no-mark called Danny Mannering, left a trail of clues bright enough to land a 747. The trial's just a formality. He's looking at life. And I'm looking at spending my first rest day in 2 weeks with Megan. Or I was until half an hour ago. The corridors in Exeter Crown Court are the usual tense dance of lawyers, witnesses, accused, press and police. In among them, everybody's favourite detective inspector, John Stride, is sitting on a wooden bench outside courtroom one, arms folded, long legs stretched out in front of him. He looks like he's been there days, which he probably has. He frowns when he sees me. He doesn't know what I'm doing here either.
I didn't expect to see you.
Me neither, I say, parking myself next to him. I'm meant to be having mother and daughter time over a chocochino on Mort Sands. I check my watch. I should still make it if they get on with it.
Olivia Mace, narrating Breakneck Point, written by my guest, T. Ormond-Ro. Tina, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am, actually. When I get the time, so I usually do them on long car journeys, and I reserve an audiobook specifically for a car journey, but I also kind of listen to them in the bath as well, actually. I think they're absolutely magnificent, Red. I really do. Some of the ones I've heard, it's almost like I'm in a live theatre and watching it in front of me. It's so evocative, some of the audiobooks, that they are really, really good.
And you say that the voices of the narrators matched those in your head. Do you read back what you've written to yourself to see how it sounds to your ear?
I do, absolutely. I think it's almost, in fact, I'm just currently reading my second book back to myself, and it's really often only when I hear my own voice and I can hear the rhythm of the language and I can just see where the gaps are and where the mistakes are, really, that I can just see how that story is developing and what else that it needs. So yes, I do read it back. I read it out aloud.
And there's a very strong sense of place in Breakneck Point. I was lucky enough to spend a couple of weeks on the North Devon coast on a walking holiday, and it is incredibly dramatic with some really precipitous drops. You live in Devon yourself, so presumably have the surrounding countryside for inspiration.
I do. I live in North Devon, actually, so I am extremely lucky. And it's even better now. I grew up here, but it's even better now because we have the Southwest Coast Path, which literally tracks that wonderful coastline all around the Southwest Peninsula. So yes, I'm really fortunate to have the inspiration of these jaw-droppingly beautiful cliffs and beaches, and it really is wonderful.
And you say you've just been reading the second book back to yourself. Can you give us a sneak preview or a title?
Oh, I don't think I can give the title, only because I am about to send it to the publisher for the first time, so they don't know what's coming at the moment, so it could change quite dramatically. But I would say that she is, well, she's back, and she has another murder to deal with, and this one is a little bit away from the coast. We go now into Devon's farming community and really kind of how that works in North Devon and how it's quite hard working on the farms. And we tend to look at that side of Devon rather than those coastal communities, which was more what we saw in Breakneck Point.
And I take it she's still ruffling feathers and uncovering clues that others have missed.
Of course she is, Red. Yeah, she's still ruffling feathers and rubbing people up the wrong way.
Well, I hope you'll come back onto the show this time next year to introduce us to book two and to many more books in the series in years to come.
Thank you so much. I'd absolutely love to. Really enjoyed myself today. Thank you, Red.
Thanks to the generous support of publisher HarperCollins, Breakneck Point is already available from the RNIB library. And Tina will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's Crime Scene Special, author Emma Flint finds parallels between a notorious unsolved crime from the 1960s and the present day. But first, His Bloody Project is a novel presented as found documents from a true crime, including the murderer's own account of a grisly triple murder carried out in the Highlands in the 1860s. The novel was shortlisted for the 2017 Booker Prize, the same year that its author, Graham McRae Burnett, appeared at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. Our very own Robert Kirkwood was on hand to interview him in front of a live audience, and Robert began by asking Graham what inspired him to write the novel.
There was kind of two inspirations for the book. One was, and again, it's like a huge long germination of an idea. When I was a student at Glasgow University nearly 30 years ago, I came across a book about a French peasant called Pierre Riviere. And Pierre Riviere killed three members of his own family with some agricultural tools, I believe. Which, of course, is quite interesting. But what was really fascinating about it was he wrote a memoir in from his prison cell about the events leading up to the murders. And it's a really beautifully written document. And that completely fascinated me, just that somebody allegedly not particularly highly educated, a peasant, who'd committed this act of tremendous violence, could then write an eloquent account about what he'd done. So that was the kind of germ of the idea for His Bloody Project. If you don't know, His Bloody Project tells the story of a triple murder in a small village in the north of Scotland carried out by a crofter who then writes an eloquent account of what he's done or the events leading up to the murder. So that was the germ of the idea. Mm. And my family background on my mother's side is from Wester Ross, so it's an area of the country that I know pretty well. So it just seemed that it felt quite natural for me to set my version of this in that part of the country. I mean, and once you start writing, the novel takes on a life of its own, or it has to take on a life of its own. So even although there's a germ of an idea that is the beginning, it becomes something that you don't necessarily know what it is at the beginning of the process.
Well, and no doubt they committed the crime, but yeah, it's more what the state of his mind was when he committed it.
I think the two big questions for the reader, which I never give you the answers to because I want the reader to engage with the book and come to their own view of what happened. So, was Roddy McRae insane at the time that he committed these acts? And what was his motivation? Because although we have his account, which is 150 pages of the book, about half the book, we come to doubt the truth of some of the things he's told us, or we feel that he may have omitted some important information about the details of his crimes. And then we have other views. We have the view of the psychiatrist. There's the court scenes where the legal world sort of comes to have a say. So, but yeah, that's the big question of the book. Was he mad or not?
I'll ask you that off mic in case anybody hasn't read the book and wants to read it. I'm very aware of giving out spoilers.
Uh-huh.
Has anyone from Kildooey read it?
Oh, God, yeah.
Back to you?
The whole village. I mean, Kildooey is a real place, and it's a place. I think there are 10 or 11 houses there, so it's a very small place. And the neighbouring village of Applecross, which is a lot of tourists go to Applecross. But even the road to Kildooey is a dead end, and even Kildooey is set back from that road. So it's not a place where people visit. You couldn't happen into Kildooey. As far as I know, certainly in Applecross, people seem highly delighted by the whole thing, and I'm always very welcome in the Applecross Inn. I go back frequently. I was aware of the kind of weight of responsibility about writing about such a small place, and I have made an effort. I've done book groups up there, and I did an event in the neighbouring village, and I'll be up there again. And I always, talk to people in the bar. But it's been overwhelmingly positive. I think with the village of Kildooey, I think there may be one person who's not so happy about it. There's an old guy who lives at the end. He's called Mr. Murchison, and he's still a crofter, and he's very much your Westeros, old boy. And I was up there, and he stopped his car. I was doing an interview overlooking Kildooey, and he just stopped his car. It was a bashed-up old Citroen Berlingo, with a couple of sheep in the back. And he didn't say anything. He just sat there in his car, staring at his steering wheel. And I kind of went over to him and, said, "Oh, hi, how you doing?" And he obviously knew what was going on. And the interviewer spoke to him in Gaelic and sort of introduced me. I'd recognized him because I'd been in the village. And I was like, I asked him, "So are you okay about the book?" And he's still staring at the steering wheel. "I'm not unhappy." Yeah. I was like, "Okay, I'll take that." All right, see you.
Now, the one real character in the book, J. Bruce uh-huh. Thompson, wrote Travels in the Borderlands of Lunacy. Did documents like that actually exist in that way of speaking to the lower classes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so James Bruce Thompson was the resident surgeon at the General Prison for Scotland at the time, and this was where... So he was a real character. And this was where Scotland's criminally insane were housed. So if you were found to be insane in the commission of a crime, you were sent to James Bruce Thompson's prison. And he used his population, I suppose he kind of studied them. And he wrote two articles, one called The Psychology of Criminals and one called The Hereditary Nature of Crime. And in particular, the latter one, The Hereditary Nature of Crime, is a very sort of Darwinian sort of thesis about how there is a criminal class and they are interbred, and they are so interbred that the negative characteristics are reproduced among them, and they actually have no free will, and so they commit crimes, but they are unable to prevent themselves committing crimes. It's a very disturbing piece of work. And so he sees this criminal class, as he calls it, as a sort of almost as subhumans, and he talks about, what's the word for preventing people from procreating. So it's very disturbing stuff, and he's got this tremendously arrogant, pompous way of expressing himself. So these articles actually exist, and fantastic find for a novelist, because I could then introduce him into my book. And so he examines Roddy McRae in prison, almost as if he's a piece of livestock, at a cattle market, describing the shape of his skull and his deep-set eyes and so on. And he also goes on a trip to Kildooey, which just provides me with the opportunity to be rude about the local the local people through his voice. But people, visitors, even as quite late into the 19th century, when sort of the beginnings of tourism, which is kind of a Victorian invention, and people would write these accounts of traveling to the tremendously poverty-stricken areas. And they would describe the houses as being like a smoking dung heap, you know, not fit for human habitation. Mm. And they did write, but the conditions were very, 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 very bad. And people did live in black houses without chimneys, with the livestock in the same house. So, you know, for these Victorian aristocrats to travel from, you know, from Edinburgh, you know, which, you know, the Scottish Enlightenment had happened. Edinburgh was a seat of European philosophy, a wealthy city, to travel a relatively short distance to this great poverty. You know, it must have been very shocking, but they did write about it. And in a way, it's almost comic the way the arrogance with which they dismissed these barbarians, you know, and the Gallic language dismissed as a sort of barbarian tongue. Mm. Still is by some people.
Now, the book's published by a wee local publisher, and then suddenly Man Booker get involved.
Yeah, Man Booker. yeah, I mean, I'd published two novels, and the glamour of that life meant that I was earning most of my money at the time as a painter and decorator. And when I got the call from my publisher, I was actually painting a lady's toilet in an office in Kilmarnock. And my first reaction on hearing this quite big news was, I really need to get a second coat on that ceiling today. But Sarah was quite adamant that I had to hightail it back to Glasgow. And 20 minutes later, I was speaking to the literary editor of The Guardian, who doesn't normally return my calls. And 20 minutes after that, there's my comments on, you know, The Guardian's website. I mean, it was the long list. There's 13 books, and any journalist, maybe some journalists in the room, it's probably a bit of a nightmare. It's like, we need a story about the Booker long list, and it's 13 books you've never heard of, probably. But we got a lot of coverage because of the story of it coming from such a small publisher. And, you know, all that stuff was true. I mean, it's a small publisher, but it's a very good publisher. It's a very professional publisher. Sarah Hunt, who Robert knows, is, you know, she's a force of nature. You know, she's brilliantly enthusiastic about all the books she publishes. She's very passionate. She cares about her writers as people as well. Well, she cares about me anyway. I don't know about the other ones. So that was a great story for the press. And obviously, the kind of, is it a crime novel on the Man Booker list? That was also a story. I mean, and the reach of that prize is totally global. I mean, on that day, we were getting calls from, you know, publishers in Japan, because it's unusual that, you know, a book comes from such... I mean, I think there's a couple of books every year. You know, that happens for. So you're not already signed up to foreign publishers. So it's just quite mind blowing. You're inside this sort of vortex. It's good though.
Yeah. You know, the initial run of the book sold out in about 6 seconds after it was longlisted.
Yeah, because I think there was no advanced notification that it would be on the long list. And I think at that point, 1,500 copies of the book had been printed. So there probably was only a few hundred available. So there was a kind of little hiatus of 3 days where nobody could get their hands on it. And I was like, it's so frustrating. You know, it's your big moment. Nobody can buy the book. But it was just inevitable, you know. But, you know, on Amazon that day, His Bloody Project, I think it leapt from something like 200,000 to number 9. Number 9 on, you know, on the general list. It was just like, wow.
And that's just the long list. That's
yeah,
not
that was
the
long
list.
Yeah.
Then it was shortlisted and that doubled almost.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, you get invited to all these lovely swanky events and, you know, that's the profile of the book has increased further. I mean, I'm always enjoy talking about this because it's such an extraordinary thing. But I don't want 5 years from now to be, oh, that was the guy who was on the, you know, Booker shortlist once. I'll be sitting in a corner of the pub dribbling or something. you know, I want to use that as a platform. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, and to be honest, I think the book needed that lift that the Booker Prize gave it. It needed to be brought to people's attention because nobody knew it existed before. And that's the great thing about, you know, literary prizes.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Graham McRae Burnett. His Bloody Project is available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to T. Orr Munro to share the books of her life, Little Deaths is Emma Flint's debut novel, a blend of literary fiction and true crime. It has attracted a lot of praise and been longlisted for a slew of awards, including the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger. It's a skillful retelling of a crime that shocked 1960s America. The case remains unsolved, and many of the issues it raised remain as unresolved now as they did then, as I discovered when Emma joined me to discuss the book.
It's based on a true story and it's set in 1960s New York. My main character is an attractive single cocktail waitress who's bringing up two very young children on her own, having separated from her husband. She wakes up one morning, very hot, sweltering July morning, to find that the children are missing from their bedroom.
I mean, obviously you're from the UK and it was a crime that happened before you were born, I'd expect. Yeah. So what attracted you to this particular story?
Two things, really. I read about it when I was about 15, I think. I used to want to be a pathologist and I was obsessed with true crime when I was young. And I first read about the story about 20 years before I started writing the book. And the two things that stuck with me through those 20 years were, firstly, the image of the character who became Ruth Malone. She's this tiny, petite, slim, very attractive, very striking woman, heavy makeup, red hair. And in all the photographs, she's surrounded by men, big, bulky men in suits, police uniforms, lawyers, detectives. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was, when she was interviewed by the police about the last evening and night before the children were taken, she said that she fed them veal and green beans for dinner, and that's not what they found during the autopsy. And I kept thinking, that's such a strange thing to lie about. Of all the things that she could have lied about, why would she lie about that? Because that didn't give her an alibi, didn't get her off the hook. And I thought, whatever the reason for that lie, I have to find a solution to it in whatever I write.
People have written about the case in the past. I think your book is the 10th. And yet you clearly have managed to bring new light to bear on this unsolved case.
Thank you. I wasn't actually aware that there had been 9 others. I deliberately didn't read any other fiction about it before I wrote the book because I didn't want to be influenced by other people's interpretation of the stories. So I read the non-fiction books about the case, which were written by journalists, and obviously I read the newspaper reports, the trial transcripts. I think what's fascinating about it is that there was a lot of doubt around the case. It took 3 trials to get Alice Crimmins, who was the name of the original Ruth Malone character. It took 3 trials to get her convicted and sentenced and in prison. And it seemed to me when I read the evidence that the police fixed on her as a suspect right from the beginning, before they really knew that the children were even dead. So I think any case where there's a little bit of doubt, where it's not cut and dried and where there's no confession, is always going to attract attention, writers, retellings, ideas about what might have actually happened. And I think, or I hope, what I'm bringing to it is, as you said at the beginning, a lot of the themes that I raise in the book, how women are perceived, how women are judged by how they look, they are issues that I think we're still facing now. If you look at the way that Amanda Knox, Kate McCann were judged, these are women who have been associated with crimes and they've been judged on their behaviour, on their sexual behaviour, on how much makeup they wear, on how they dress, not on the actual hard forensic evidence surrounding the cases that they were involved with. So I think at the level of crimes, there's still something relevant going on. And there's clearly still a debate raging about how women are judged on how they look and how they dress.
The case is definitely very much a case of trial by public opinion. The 2 lines that really stuck with me are Ruth's lawyer's comment,
that she's the very picture of a scandalous woman. And the chief investigating policeman saying he can smell guilt on her like cheap perfume.
My sense of Ruth was that she was judged, even before the children went missing, she was judged because she has separated from her husband, which is very unusual for the time and the neighbourhood that she lives in. This is suburban Queens. This isn't cosmopolitan Manhattan. This is well before feminism reached the suburbs. She's married to her high school sweetheart, and she lives in a fairly conventional blue-collar neighbourhood. And she's separated from her husband. One of the neighbours says he didn't even hit her. You know, she just wasn't happy. So she's a single mother, but she's not staying home to bring up her kids. She's going out to work. She's going out to work in a bar. When I read about Alice Crimmins, the question I kept hearing was, how dare she? How dare she want more than to be married with kids? How dare she want more than to stay at home? How dare she? How dare she? That's what I kept hearing. I kept hearing it implied by the newspaper articles. I kept hearing it quoted in some of the non-fiction books that I read. The neighbours were judging her, the press were judging her. The police, in my novel, the police turn up at her door. She's fully dressed. She's wearing her usual mask of makeup. And she smells of brandy, because she's had some brandy for the shock, because her children have disappeared. And immediately they think she doesn't look the way a grieving mother should look. So she becomes a suspect. And that's the sense that I got when I read the real accounts of the case. There's one reporter who claims when he turned up at the house just after the children had gone missing, he claims that he heard the investigating officer say to his colleague, "The bitch did it." And that was before they knew there'd been a murder. I think that's an extraordinary basis for an investigation, never mind a story.
It certainly gives Ruth in the book no chance of establishing her innocence, and it's left to the character of Pete Warnocky, a junior reporter who's very much an idealist, to try and establish her innocence. Is he a fictional creation?
He is a fictional creation. He's completely fictional, although most of the sources for the story were newspaper reports, so I did obviously use those as the basis for his character. What I find interesting about Pete is, as you said, he's an idealist, and he starts out wanting to write the truth and wanting to make his break in journalism by finding out who really killed the kids. And then he's told by his editor, no, what you need to do is write the story that people want to read, which means you need to give them a monster, you need to give them some sex appeal, you need to play up the money angle, if there's a money angle. And he's pretty horrified by this cold-blooded way of breaking down the truth. He watches Ruth and he decides that he's going to try and work out the truth for himself. But the problem is, as he watches her, he falls under her spell and he becomes completely obsessed. He can't see it himself and it blinds his judgment. And I found his character interesting because as a writer, but also as a reader, his character continued to surprise me as I was writing. He starts out thinking that he's going to be Ruth's saviour, and actually, all through the book, he judges her as much as any of the other characters do. And it's almost worse, because he's blind to it. He thinks he's doing it for good reasons. And he condemns the others. He condemns the policemen and the other newspapers who are so hard on her. And he can't see that his own judgment of her is just as subjective, just as objectifying.
And Queens is itself another character in the book. Did you have a very strong sense of New York of that time? Did you do a lot of research?
I did do a lot of research. I deliberately didn't go to New York while I was writing the book because I didn't want to see New York in the 21st century. I wanted to see suburban Queens through the photographs of the time, especially the photographs that were in the non-fiction books that look at the actual street and the actual apartment block where the children lived. And I think lots of people have said that they really felt that the setting was very vivid and very real. And American readers have said that to me too, which is amazing considering that I'm not American. And if that's the case, I think it's probably because I grew up in a suburb on the edge of a city, Newcastle, which is obviously not like New York or Manhattan, but I think when you grow up in a quiet suburb where there's a sense of claustrophobia, there's a sense of homogeneous community where everybody is watching one another. So where I grew up, it was a great place to live as a child. But I do remember if somebody new moved into the street, you would know, not even an hour, you would know if they were married, if they had kids, if they had any pets, where they worked, what kind of car they drove. And that sense of being watched, that sense of houses close together, people not having anything to do but gossip about their neighbours, that's what I wanted to bring to the novel, because I think that sense of being watched and that claustrophobia is really important in the sense of the story, but also in the sense of Ruth Malone, what she's rebelling against, what she's pushing back against.
And certainly you seem fascinated by what happens to characters when great pressure is put upon them, where their breaking point lies, where love turns to obsession or whatever.
Hugely interested in crime. I read crime fiction, I read true crime. I've always read that from being sort of 12, 13. And I think what interests me about it is that when you have a murder, everybody who's involved in that murder, the perpetrator, the investigators, the victims, families, friends, suspects, they are all placed under the most enormous pressure that I imagine you can put a human being under. And that makes people behave in surprising and unexpected and, for a novelist, really interesting ways. I also think what fascinates me about crime is that we've all had those moments of rage or being out of control. And what fascinates me is, for me, and I would imagine, I hope, 99.9% of the population, we get a bit angry, we might, you know, kick something, and then we move on. What interests me is the 0.01% of people who don't move on, who take that rage and do something really destructive with it, and who merge that rage with planning or greed or lust and commit a really revolting crime. I'm also interested in the kind of mind that can conceal a crime after the fact, particularly in a very ordinary community. I remember reading about the West case in the 90s where you had a house in a street, very ordinary street in Gloucester, looked like thousands and thousands of other houses around England, and the most horrendous evil things were happening in that house. And, you know, the journalists were interviewing the neighbours and saying, well, yeah, they were a bit odd, but they were just like any other couple. And what fascinates me is this ability to cover it up and appear normal. I can understand the blind rage. I can't understand the meticulous planning and the lying. That's what fascinates me.
Did you feel that bringing some kind of closure, even if it's fictional closure, in Little Deaths was important?
Yeah, I did. I spent 6 years writing the book, and I think I needed a conclusion at the end of that period. But I also think it's very unfair to ask a reader to invest in victims, suspects, main characters, narrators, and not give them a resolution. And I felt that the real case, the resolution wasn't particularly satisfactory, partly because, as I said, she had 3 trials before she went to prison. But also, I think, because the real Alice Grimmins has never talked about the case publicly, it does give you a bit of leeway to interpret how she was feeling, what those years in prison must have been like for her.
The audiobook that I listened to flowed beautifully, and I wondered if maybe you read your work back to yourself, because it certainly reads very well out loud.
Yes, I'm very proud to say that I've read every single word aloud before it went to my editor. I think even though most of my readers will have it on the page and will have their own voice hearing it, it's really important to me that it flows properly, that the rhythm of the words is right, that the prose just sounds right. And I'm very particular about that. That's probably my biggest obsession in writing. It has to be absolutely right. The rhythm of the lines has to be absolutely right. And I can sit for a very long time poring over a single word that isn't right and come back to it 3-4 years later and realise why it's not right.
Have you listened to the audiobook yourself?
I have. I was very lucky in that I got to hear samples of the narrator's voices before it was confirmed, so I got to say yes to them. And I think it's fabulous that there's two narrators, that they've kept it male and female. It was really important to me, obviously, that they were American, that they were from the East Coast. And I think Lauren Fortgang especially, that's how Ruth sounds in my head now. It's so strange when you've been reading the book aloud to yourself in your sort of Northern English accent. Then you hear an American read it for the first time and read it smoothly and read it so that it flows in the way that the dialogue would flow if it was those people speaking it. Yeah, I remember hearing a sample of the audiobook and Ruth's voice just came out of my headphones. It was so incredible to hear her alive, to hear my character come to life like that.
Thanks to Emma Flint, Little Deaths is out now in paperback, ebook, and as a commercial audio download. Now it's back to T. Orr Munro for the books of her life. Tina, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there is actually. Well, it's a series of books. It is actually the Secret Seven series of books. And there is one in particular, and it was a circus adventure. And I'm not going to give any spoilers, Red, but it had the best twist. It was about a jewellery thief, and the Secret Seven gang couldn't work out how this person had been so agile and dexterous and had managed to steal some jewellery without being seen going in and out of this person's house. And I read that, and I read the end, and it was such a cracking twist that it kind of hooked me into the whole crime genre. And from there on in, I kind of devoured all the Secret Seven series, and then I sort of moved to other crime series. And so I suppose it's no coincidence really that I've ended up writing crime and writing about crime, but it was the Secret Seven series that really drew me into reading.
The Secret Seven Society was having its usual weekly meeting. Its meeting place was down in the old shed at the bottom of the garden belonging to Peter and Janet. On the door were the letters SS painted in green. Peter and Janet were in the shed waiting. Janet was squeezing lemons into a big jug, making lemonade for the meeting. On a plate lay 7 ginger biscuits and 1 big dog biscuit. That was for Scamper, their golden spaniel. He sat with his eyes on the plate, as if he was afraid his biscuit might jump off and disappear. "Here come the others," said Peter, looking out of the window. "Yes, Colin, George, Barbara, Pam and Jack. And you and I make the 7. "Woof," said Scamper, feeling left out. "Sorry, Scamper," said Peter, "but you're not a member, just a hanger-on, but a very nice one."
Sarah Green, narrating Secret Seven Adventure by Enid Blyton, which is available from the RNIB Library, as are many of the other books in the series. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There absolutely is. I'm not a great one for rereading books, actually. And there is only one book I have ever read twice, and that is Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. And I've read, as a result, all of Hardy's, but it's this particular book that I just absolutely adore. The way that Hardy writes about the fictional Wessex, his description of the changing seasons, his description of the landscape, it just marries perfectly my own kind of sense of Devon, although I know Hardy's more associated with Dorset, but the landscape, the descriptions of the landscape, very much what I grew up in, and it's just something that just resonates with me. And it's just such a beautiful story that it's got everything. It's got the drama, it's got the kind of the love interest, it's got like unrequited love, and I just think it's a magnificent book.
The sluggish day began to break. Even its position terrestrially is one of the elements of a new interest, and for no particular reason, save that the incident of the night had occurred there, Oak went again into the plantation. Lingering and musing here, he heard the steps of a horse at the foot of the hill, and soon there appeared in view an auburn pony with a girl on its back, ascending by the path leading past the cattle shed. She was the young woman of the night before. Gabriel instantly thought of the hat she had mentioned as having lost in the wind. Possibly she had come to look for it. He hastily scanned the ditch, and after walking about 10 yards along it, found the hat among the leaves. Gabriel took it in his hand and returned to his hut. Here he ensconced himself and peeped through the loophole in the direction of the rider's approach. She came up and looked around, then on the other side of the hedge. Gabriel was about to advance and restore the missing article when an unexpected performance induced him to suspend the action for the present.
George Hagan narrating Far From the Madding Crowd by Thomas Hardy, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, I'd like to share a book called Hive by April Doyle. It's out this year. It's been out for about 4 weeks now. And it tells the story of a kind of a near future where the bees have died or are dying and there's very few hives left, and the impact that has had on our food security and how society is starting to unravel through the shortage of food. And it's told obviously in a fictional setting, but it's kind of one of those books read where you read it and you just think that's just a really important book, not just a great story, but a story with a message, but it's not preachy. I didn't feel I was being lectured to. I just felt I was reading a story that could become true. And I live in the country, I live in North Devon, and I could absolutely connect to the idea that climate change is impacting on our landscape and our surroundings and our biodiversity, and that sense of what do we do? What do we do to save our nature so that we can also prosper? And it's a really terrific book. So it's Hive by April Doyle. And I think in terms of my reading in the last couple of months, that one had the most impact on me. But she intersperses it with kind of a look back. I think it's like I said, it's near future. And it looks back to the 90s and some of the science that was coming out about bees and the pesticides impacting on the bees. And it's just very cleverly done. I really enjoyed it.
Unfortunately, Hive by April Doyle isn't available in audio, but you can find the ebook or paperback on sale commercially.
Tina Orr Munro, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners today and for being a guest on the show.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale. And Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.